Thanksgiving, I don't know all the details of the origins of this American holiday, but it seems to be not particularly connected to any particular religion. And there's, I guess, historical background about the early travelers to this country. But it's a time in the fall, naturally, a time to celebrate the harvest of the summer and to give thanks for the bounty of the land and and everything. So apart from whatever historical meaning it arose from, I just think that it's totally wonderful to have a day that's just about giving thanks. Because I feel that this is actually the at least one way to look at our Zen practice, Buddhist practice, at its root can be seen as gratitude. Being open to the presently arising event in a moment-to-moment way, so fully that gratitude naturally just arises for whatever comes to be. I would say it's a practice and a realization. And in our tradition, we say practice and realization are not two. So to realize the wonderful fruition of gratitude. And, you know, I don't want to go so far as to equate gratitude with complete enlightenment. That might be just, you know, presumptuous. But maybe not so different. Complete gratitude and gratitude that doesn't depend on particular conditions. Maybe not so far from what Buddha had discovered under the Bodhi tree after struggling for many, many years, not so grateful for the pain and suffering that was arising in his life. At some point, the Buddha saw how things come to be and fully embraced this. And his realization, we could say, was gratitude. At least gratitude was surely an important aspect. And I say the gratitude that doesn't depend on particular conditions, because we're all grateful for some things. But can we take Thanksgiving Day as a special practice opportunity to practice and realize gratefulness for whatever arises on that day as a practice for the following days? Sometimes we have great difficulty opening to gratitude for what's happening. It just seems not fair, not quite right. We were dealt a bad hand. It's like we can always find something to complain about. Because the complaining mind is the opposite of gratitude. We can all find conditions for complaint, and I've tried over the years trying to take up the practice of, like, for specific periods of time, like a vow, I will not complain for the next half year or something. Of course I would fail, but noticing that complaining, I can kind of feed the complaining mind by just, it's a habitual thing. Just by enacting it, it kind of maintains it sometimes. Especially we may have friends that we like to complain to. They're like our, we feel like we can kind of unload something by complaining to our friends. I think this is a common activity among sentient beings. And sometimes I have noticed myself doing that and feeling like, I don't want to have my relationship with this person be about just kind of like unloading my complaints onto them. So sometimes even with another person, we together vow, let's not complain about anything together for half a year. These are practices and realizations. So here's a case in the Gateless Barrier, the Mumon Khan collection of koans. That sounds like someone maybe expressing something other than thanksgiving and getting a turning word about his situation. A monk came to Saoshan. Saoshan is one of the important disciples of Dongshan. We say that our particular path of Zen at Santa Cruz Zen Center is the Dongshan lineage. Dongshan lived in the 8th century in China. And our particular lineage doesn't proceed through his student Saoshan. That lineage seemed to disintegrate quickly. But nevertheless, Saoshan was very important in furthering and developing his teacher Dongshan's formulation of what we call the five ranks in the Dongshan lineage, kind of elaborate system of the permutations of relative and ultimate truth, which we're not going to get into today, but that's what Saoshan's maybe mostly known for. And some would say that that these two together, Dongshan and Saoshan, when their names are combined in reverse, with taking out the Shan, which means mountain, it's Sao and Dong. So the Sao Dong lineage, which in Japanese is pronounced So To, some say come from the names of these two ancestors. Saoshan apparently, I think, named his mountain after the six ancestors' place, Sao Chi, Sao Creek. So, and since the sixth ancestor is in our lineage, I like to think more that we're the lineage of the sixth ancestor in Dongshan. Sao Shi and Dongshan. This is an elaborate footnote on Saoshan. Anyway, he's part of a particular style of Zen. So a monk named Qing Shui came to him and said, "I am Qing Shui, solitary and destitute. Please give me alms. Give me something. I'm poor and destitute." I'm dissatisfied with my circumstances. I am not completely grateful. Now, in these commentaries on this koan, most people seem to say that this is not as just totally straightforward as it seems. It's not just this poor destitute monk saying, here I am, please give me alms. It's, as often in these cases, he's talking about a spiritual state of mind, a destitute, solitary darkness that he's dwelling in. And he's coming to Saoshan and saying, please give me some Zen food. But you could take it either way. Could take it just very straightforward. I'm just this poor, ragged, solitary, destitute monk. Please give me some alms. Or we could take it as the commentators often do. I have realized solitary, destitute independence. But is there anything more than this? Do you have something more to offer me? In any case, it seems like lacking something. He hasn't realized the full extent of thanksgiving. And Saoshan said, Venerable Shui, he called him by name. And Ching Shui said, Yes, teacher. These types of dialogues often appear in these stories. A question is asked, and he says, Ching Shui, yes? Such a direct meeting, to be called by name and immediately know we're being called and say yes. The whole Dharma is fully enacted in such a moment. It's why these call and response come up again and again in these stories. And in a couple of weeks, we'll get to enact such a ritual in this room with the Shuso, where one at a time we will call her Shuso, and she'll say yes, or hi in Japanese, and we'll ask her a question. But when we first call her Shuso, and she says yes, already the Dharma is completely enacted. So the question's kind of a little follow-up thing we can do with her after fully enacting the Dharma with this call and response. But the way each of us does that and the way she responds to each of us will be different. A little different and a little the same. I am Ching Shui, solitary and destitute. Please give me alms. Saoshan said, Venerable Shui. Ching Shui said, Yes, teacher. And Saoshan said, You have already drunk 3 cups of the finest wine in China, and still you say you have not moistened your lips. And that's case number 10 in the Gateless Barrier. What are you lacking? What reason do you have to not be completely grateful for your life? If it's just really about a basic lack, like this monk's just cold and hungry, that's one thing. If it's this more like spiritual darkness, we might call like dark night of the soul, or a kind of having let go of a lot of gross fixations and habits, but still being kind of like, yeah, and but there's not much life here. Sometimes people reach this realm where they their previous life seemed kind of meaningless, has come to seem kind of meaningless through practice, things that they used to put a lot of energy into and out of just habitual tendencies no longer are so enjoyable anymore. So they might feel like, it's kind of, maybe I shouldn't have gotten into this practice. It's kind of sad. Now it's just kind of like dark and dismal. I don't feel so attached like I used to, but there's not much life here either. Something like this might be one way that some people would describe dark night of the soul. A very important place in practice. And so this is Robert Aitken Roshi's commentary, and he brings up various things here about the dark night, if this is one way to look at this story. He says some people just laugh it off, calling it a midlife crisis when people talk about this kind of thing. But he says that it shouldn't be taken as such. It's an important stage of development in practice. And once Robert Aitken consulted a Christian or a Jesuit retreat master about this state of mind, and this Jesuit retreat master said that people passing through this phase should be careful, first to keep their schedule of religious practice, and second to stay in touch with their spiritual guides. We can understand by this advice that it is important not to turn back at such a crucial point in one's development. So I thought that was just interesting, a little aside. And if people in our practice get to this place where it's like the practice is working to the extent that they're not so caught up in things, but there's a kind of dryness and lifelessness and kind of like, well, maybe I shouldn't even bother continuing anymore. Something like that. This Jesuit teacher says, oh, this is the important time to continue to practice. Don't stop at this point or, you know, get distracted as people sometimes jump into something, a new interest or hobby or something, but actually just keep the practice going and stay in touch with your teachers and the, we might say the, with the Sangha. So, also, some commentators mentioned the fact that this three cups of the finest wine in China is the wine of the Qingyuan district. Or in Japanese, the Seigen district was known for as the wine country. Kind of like Napa Valley of China. And Seigen, or Qingyuan, this wine district, is also the district where one of our Zen ancestors and one of Shaoshan's Zen ancestors, Seigen Gyoshi, or Qingyuan, lived, and he was known by the name Qingyuan. So, though sometimes they just translate it as, you know, the meaning of the finest wine in China, it's literally, in the Chinese, it's like the wine of Qingyuan, and it's from the White Company, the White Wine Company. In China, I don't think they have red wine. Anyway, actually, they just have clear wine made of rice. But it's the the white company's Qingyuan wine. You've drunk 3 cups of that. So this clear, no color wine of Qingyuan. You've drank 3 cups of that. As the style of our Zen school is kind of clear in this way. It's kind of uncolored at its root. It's something very, very plain about Dongshan's Zen lineage. Very plain. Not much color. Almost like drinking water. Slight bite to it. You've already drank 3 cups of this colorless wine of Qingyuan, and still you say you've not moistened your lips. It's easy to not be grateful for such colorless, plain, flavorless wine. In a similar vein, we have a wonderful Christian teacher named Brother David Steindl-Rast. Some of you may have met. He was he's a Christian monk from many years lived at New Kamaldoli Hermitage down in Big Sur, and very interested in Buddhism and particularly Zen from his early days of practice. At the very first practice period at Tassajara, our Zen monastery, Brother David was there with Suzuki Roshi. And since then, he's stayed interested in Zen, practicing with various teachers and returning to Tassajara still. He may be coming this summer. I think he was there last summer, offering workshops and so on. A very, very beautiful being. Yeah. Very open-hearted, and I feel really understands the deepest spirit of Zen as well as Christianity. Sometimes when I read his stuff, I feel like it's beyond any particular religion. Somehow his destiny was to end up as a Christian monk, but he definitely likes hanging out with the Zen Buddhists. Anyway, he's got one of his main things that he's into is gratitude. I think he's got a website called gratefulness.org where people can just write in things that they're grateful for. And he's got this one book, Gratefulness, the Heart of Prayer. Now, I don't know so much about Christian prayer, but I think sometimes people, at least on a superficial level, treat prayer as like almost the opposite, right? It's like asking God for something that we need in times of trouble. And maybe there's beneficial aspects to that type of prayer. But he says, as a Christian contemplative monk, that actually the heart of Christian prayer and Buddhist practice too is gratefulness. Being grateful to God for whatever comes. Not at all asking for anything lacking, but almost the opposite, we could say. And so some of the things he says about this practice. What counts on our path to fulfillment is that we remember the great truth that moments of surprise want to teach us. Everything is gratuitous. Everything is gift. Everything. And gratuitous means something like freely offered with nothing asked in return. And everything is like this. The degree to which we are awake to this truth is the measure of our gratefulness. And gratefulness is the measure of our aliveness. Are we not dead to whatever we take for granted? Surely to be numb is to be dead. For those who awaken to life through surprise, death lies behind, not ahead. To live life open for surprise, in spite of all the dying which living implies, makes us ever more alive. So, particularly here he's talking about being open to surprise is often what opens us to gratefulness. Things like suddenly seeing a rainbow and then, you know, without expecting it. There are degrees of grateful wakefulness. Our intellect, our will, and our emotions must wake up. A single crocus blossom ought to be enough to convince our heart that springtime, no matter how predictable, is somehow a gift. Gratuitous, gratis, a grace. We know this with a knowledge that goes beyond our intellect, yet our intellect shares in it. We cannot be grateful unless our intellect plays its role. We must recognize the gift as gift, and only our intellect can do that. This might sound strange. In a Zen way, do we really need the intellect so much? And he's saying, it's not the whole story, but he's saying this is important. He says, for some people this is not so easy. There are those who are simply too dull, too slow-witted, perhaps too lazy to recognize anything as gift. Their intellect is not alert enough. They take everything for granted. They go through life in a daze. It takes a certain intellectual sharpness to be grateful. So that's one aspect. And then he says, but there are those with the opposite bent of mind, people who rely exclusively on their intellect. Those clever ones, too, may have a hard time with gratefulness. If one's intellect insists on finding solid proof that a gift is truly a gift, then one is stuck. That's the problem with intellect in realizing gratefulness, and also, I think, in Zen practice, if we're trying to, like, really get to the bottom of it completely through mere intellect, we'll maybe miss the immediacy of the moment's presentation. There is always the possibility that what looks like a gift is really a trap, a bait, a bribe. Just listen to some of the comments one hears as Christmas presents are being unwrapped. Well, look at this. Why would the Joneses send us an expensive present like this? I wonder what favor they're going to ask from us in the new year. For example, that's when the intellect gets in the way of gratitude. Who can prove that there are absolutely no strings attached? Our heart longs for the surprise that a gift is truly a free gift, but our proud intellect balks at surprise, wants to explain it away. So intellect only gets us so far. And our will also must play its part. It too belongs to the fullness of gratefulness. It's the task of the intellect to recognize something as a gift, but the will must acknowledge its gift character. So recognition and acknowledgement are two different tasks. So we need the intellect, or, you know, clear awareness, you might say, to recognize a gift, and then to acknowledge it, we need the will. Acknowledging a gift may be far more difficult than recognizing it. For example, take the weather. So with the weather, we can recognize that it's a rainy day with the intellect, but the acknowledgement of that it's a gift may be harder, and that's what he's calling will here. In our practice, we might say willingness. willingness to be open to whatever is arising, whatever is coming to us. we call this meditation sometimes the awareness of the self receiving its function. In Jijyu Zamae, the so-called self of this appearing person, moment to moment, is receiving its function from all things. Right now, who we are is just the reception of all the conditions of the universe coming together just so, just like this. And we can resist receiving it, or we can just openly receive it. Sometimes it's not a matter of necessarily a pleasant thing. It could be like painful situation coming to us, but if we can really receive that openly, when you put together in Chinese is ji ju yu, that the self receiving its function, when you put together receiving its and function as a compound, it means in Chinese, interestingly, enjoyment. So to receive one's function isn't necessarily pleasant in the way we often think of pleasant, but on the deepest level, it's by definition enjoyable. It's a joy to receive our function. And that joy could be called gratitude or thanksgiving. It's the fruit, and yet I think what he's calling the will here is like the practice. We can practice being grateful when it's a rainy day. Why is it so difficult to acknowledge a gift as a gift? Here is the reason. When I admit that something is a gift, I admit my dependence on the giver. Doesn't this sound also like the self receiving its function awareness? Or Praticca Samuppada, the dependent co-arising of each and every element in this world. When I admit that something is a gift, I admit my dependence on the giver. This may not sound that difficult, but there is something within us that bristles at the idea of dependence. We want to get along by ourselves, yet a gift is something we simply cannot give to ourselves, not as a gift at any rate. I can buy the same thing or even something better, but it will not be a gift if I procure it for myself. Gratefulness always goes beyond myself, for what makes something a gift is precisely that it's given, and the receiver depends on the giver. And the giver may be a person, or the giver may be three cups of very, very plain, clear wine from the Qingyuan region of China. It's so clear that one might not even appreciate it. One might still say that one's lips have not been moistened by it. Do you have any thoughts on Thanksgiving or this this unique unique and strange, very, very clear wine that that we provide, this Qingyuan wine that we drink three times a day in this Zen hall, that's barely has any flavor, but can you taste it at all on the tips of your lips? Hi, Charlie.
I find that when I travel, I do a lot of traveling in my truck in Mexico and in the mountains, that I'm much more open to just letting the day flow and being happy about it coming up to whatever it is. I think when we're in our homes, it's a little more difficult.
And also, as Brother David mentioned, gratefulness often comes through surprise, and travel is a great way to instigate surprise. Yeah, I think that's true. It's unpredictable and easier to stay like fresh and alive because you don't really know what's going to happen for sure next. So that's a question then, what if we're not physically traveling all the way to Mexico, how can we keep that freshness in our like daily routine? How do we keep the surprise element going enough to stay grateful? Do you find that difficult after a long trip to be back in the daily grind?
Well, I usually use the opportunity to notice how different I am when I come back, and try to keep the enthusiasm of the variety, and notice it at least, and try to keep it with me.
Yeah. Other thoughts about how to practice on Thanksgiving? Or bring forth something that like you really can't be grateful for? Hi.
It seems to me that receiving and being grateful is a cousin to generosity. And I was raised to feel that there should be an equality, that it's uncomfortable to receive more than I've given. And I should only give as much as I receive. And I feel like this has just been an obstacle in my life. Like giving love should be just be done freely, you know. In relationships, I've always felt like, oh, you know, I don't want to give more than I've gotten.
Yeah.
You know, the two things are just so intertwined.
Yeah, I think that's true. We it's easy to think in terms of like fairness or a good deal, like we're getting a bad deal if we give more than we receive, something like that. But one way to practice with it might be to really tune into the joy, that sweet but kind of plain taste of just the simple happiness at giving without, you know, before you think about, like, I wonder if anything's going to come back. And, you know, the longer it goes on that way, the harder it is. if you keep giving, like, maybe no strings attached, but then at some point we start to notice that the little strings are starting to attach, and we're like, well, there weren't any strings attached, but this is going too far now. I've reached my limit. And I think it's great to notice our limit, and then to see if we've lost touch with the original impulse to just give for the sake of giving. I think that's what happens, is at first it's just a fresh natural impulse, and then just out of old habit, it's a stringless gift, but then over time with the habits of like expecting something back, the strings start to get attached again. If we can get back in touch with that original joy of just giving freely, then we can maybe go further. Again, that's the difference between prayer as wishing for something more and prayer as gratefulness for whatever comes, which is a kind of giving, actually. Right? You're very correct that generosity and gratitude are completely intertwined. Thank you for that. Yes.
I've had a very strong sense lately that the Buddha nature is an inexhaustible resource. And in line with what you were saying tonight, that it is Buddha nature that transmits the function to this passing, impermanent, non-abiding participant that has an appropriate personality at this instant. And in this sense, that manifestation of the appropriate personality in this instant is the gift that is powered by Buddha nature watching it and saying, this is your function.
It can't be otherwise.
And receiving the gift is the full gift and full measure of return. Receiving the appropriate personality that has been generated through the unmerited resource of Buddha nature.
Yeah, receiving and expressing this is the greatest gift we can give, and the greatest gift we can receive and give. Yeah. It's actually these three cups of Qingyuan wine are three cups of Buddha nature. One commentator even went so far as to like try to get into a whole thing about that these three are the three cups of emptiness, where nothing can be found at all, the cup of dependent manifestation, and the cup of the middle way of their union. I don't know if that's what the three cups that Sao Shan was talking about. Kathy?
Yeah, maybe it's just wine. But even if it is, then I think that the lesson is still powerful. Because to me, it's about, can you taste it? That's the receiving.
Yeah.
You know, we focus so much on the, well, I need and I want.
Yeah.
And yet, maybe I actually already have it.
Yep.
And I just haven't tasted it.
Yeah, you've already drank it. And yet, we just overlook so easily overlook what's coming to us all the time, and that's just like paying attention, being present for these actual little surprising miracles that are happening all the time. Another commentary brought up a story about the old Japanese Zen teacher Bankei, and something like, in this context, a student came up to Bankei and said, my wisdom is all kind of like boxed in and stuck. It can't function freely. I feel like just totally stuck and trapped. And Bankei said, come up closer. And so he took a few steps forward, closer, and Bankei said, there, right there, what do you mean your wisdom's stuck? It's functioning perfectly, freely. So when we're in that mind of being trapped in our idea of stuckness, we don't notice the miracle of walking a few steps forward is freely functioning. Tasty wine. And like Johnny said, sometimes it's really, we don't know what it is. Our mind can start ranking all our activities and responses as good and bad. And like, that wasn't a very good manifestation of Buddha nature to, that moment. But from the point of view, from the perspective of Buddha nature, it's like each one is like an equally miraculous manifestation coming through this body and mind as it must. So easy to overlook. So Thanksgiving's a day for just not overlooking the obvious. It's also, a huge feast day often. So that might be a specific practice one could take up, is like in eating lots of good food and maybe drinking good wine, to really taste it. Taste every drop. So at the end, we're like, I really experienced Thanksgiving fully. So they're saying, the day's over. I'm like, what happened? I don't even remember. Was that a good meal or not? I didn't even notice. And our Zazen practice can also be a moment-to-moment opening to the gratefulness for what is. That could actually be a description of Zazen practice itself, is to just sit, gratefully receiving what comes. My teacher once had this, sometimes he would come up with a saying and a practice saying and a practice instruction, and he would kind of like bring it up again and again. I think for like a year, maybe more than a year, this was like this running theme, was like, whatever comes, just say, thank you very much, I have no complaint whatsoever. No matter what happens, just say that as a practice. And he would keep saying it for like, over and over again in all these talks and classes, and just like to the point where it's like, can I just receive that instruction again? Thank you very much, I have no complaint whatsoever. What a boring talk, again, the same thing. Thank you very much. I have no complaint whatsoever. That's a practice, and the fruit, the realization of such a practice is the realization of thank you very much is I have no complaint whatsoever. Yeah.
It's an interaction that I think society at large doesn't expect when you're grateful for the interaction, grateful for the moment. And then they leave and they're crazy happy. You know, and maybe I helped them, maybe I didn't. But I'm just noticing that by expressing that to everyone, even just the people at the grocery store that do their job, they're just
saying thank you.
Yeah, and just talk to them and respect them and show that you're grateful that they're acknowledging you. It's really powerful.
Yeah.
And it's just like it ripples.
Mm-hmm. Even if a complaint, it sounds like maybe this is the case, a complaint might come to you and you could say, well, thank you for letting me know how you're doing.
Exactly. Yeah.
And,
it's amazing how such like a simple, very practical transformation can have this really positive
effect. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. We don't give so much just plain old thanks and gratitude to a lot of people in our culture, but we definitely make it known if we have a complaint. So even like the news is like this. The news is like a series of problems with the world, and there's not so much news about just like, hey, isn't this great that like the sun came up again today? Yeah, little bits, anything, those little interactions, I think that's what make up our life, actually. Mm-hmm. So, little encounters and just expressing even the slightest thanks and acceptance for what is, it goes a long way. We offer this merit with deepest gratitude to all the Buddhas and ancestors and all the people practicing this way together. May all beings open to the gratefulness for what is. Beings are numberless. To save them, the illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.